Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James. This is Pete.
G'day, everyone.
It is episode 41, last one of the year, and it is December 15th. So how are we feeling, Pete?
What a year. What a year it's been.
That's just why this podcast is so good. Pete and I just complete each other's sentences. I was waiting for you to say sentences. Anyway, so we've got a huge show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking to Stuart Eaton, Director of External Affairs and Communications. Going to be talking about what the IPA has been up to this year, what we've got planned for next year, just a bit of year in review chat. We're also going to be talking to former 3RW presenter John Michael Howson about like the Hollywood elite and what's happening over there.
Yeah, hopefully he's got some juicy tales from his time as a Hollywood on the Hollywood beat.
Peter really after that celeb gossip. Cool. So obviously big week second week in a row you're back, Adam. Thank G'day. You so much for helping us out today.
No worries.
It's always good when someone comes back for their second day, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fantastic. And also, in our pre-podcast meeting, Adam helped us out twice with telling us what we said last week.
So. With facts.
Yeah, exactly. And analysis.
I was paying attention.
Yeah, thank you. Someone was. Cool. So we'll get into it. So huge week for the IPA. We've released two reports, which we're going to talk about. The first we should probably talk about is our freedom of speech report.
Mm.
So this report from the IPA's Matthew Lesh is sort of analysing what the state of freedom of speech is on Australian universities. You can download it on our website. It's a really fascinating read. So we break it up into three distinct groups, red, amber, and green. Red being completely restrictive of free speech with actions and policies. Amber being policies and actions that threaten freedom of speech on campus, and one university received a green fading that actually supports green freedom of speech on campus. The problem is only one university has a green rating.
One out of 42.
41 out of 42 universities have actual policies or just, you know, have actions that threaten freedom of speech on campus, which is really, really sobering.
And James,
yep.
Three universities banned sarcasm. Is that right?
That's a great idea. Sorry. I knew that would get Pete.
Yeah.
All right. So here's some of the... So Pete says three universities have banned sarcasm, that being the University of Queensland, Western Sydney University, and Charles Sturt University. Federation Universities, bullying prevention statement defines bullying to include anything that hurts someone else's feelings. So good luck saying any, you know, political beliefs in class. It might hurt someone else's feelings. La Trobe University defines bullying to be unintentional offence. So even if you just say anything freely of your own mind, if it unintentionally causes offence to someone, you are a bully. And a bunch of stuff as well. So make sure you guys are on our report. Here's something I did like. So Charles Sturt University, one of the universities that banned sarcasm, they have a 1,600-word policy on when, where, and how flags should be flown. However, it does not have a policy dedicated to free intellectual inquiry on campus. So the next generation of people coming out of Charles Sturt University are going to know so damn well how to fly a flag.
Yeah.
They just won't have any idea of the central tenet of Western civilization.
That's priorities, isn't it? How we said yesterday in Hey What Did I Miss, the fantastic comedy acts that would have never existed had Cambridge University banned sarcasm.
Yeah.
What if the University of Melbourne and Monash University had banned sarcasm?
Yeah.
This amazing podcast would never have existed.
I know. We would never have had Me and Pete. Could you imagine a world?
Yeah.
It's actually kind of good now that I imagine it. Anyway, we should move on. So another report we had out this week is talking about GST distribution done by a friend of the podcast, Morgan Begg, our Hey colleague. So GST, obviously... all the states raise GST, they send it to Canberra, they sort of send it back out in an equalization sort of thing, trying to make sure every state gets an equal amount compared to the others on, you know, like a per capita basis, I think it is. What that's got in the system is now that you've got some states who don't bring in any GST getting a whole lot back, and some states that give you a whole lot of GST to the federal government that don't get anything back. South Australia, you might imagine, would be the worst offender of this case.
Yeah, let's call it state South Australia.
Which gets $19 billion extra in GST equalisation. And New South Wales, Victoria, and Western Australia really getting hard done by. So that report got a lot of traction, covered in the West Australian, Australian Financial Review, and so on. You can read all of those hits on our website.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. And here's the thing with this GST distribution stuff. So... like we said, it rewards South Australia for, you know, not doing a whole lot. It actually, in a way, punishes governments from passing sensible economic reform because they're not going to get as much money back.
Yep.
So if you're a state government, you go, let's really just hamstring our economy because what's the problem?
Yeah, exactly. Morgan is big on this.
Yes.
He really rages out.
He's really riled up about it. Yeah. Can't talk them down this week.
Yeah.
And Pete, net neutrality, big issue today.
It is a big issue today. The FCC have ditched Obama's net neutrality rules, which means that the era of net neutrality is over. Now, don't let any of your mates tell you that net neutrality is a bad thing.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. So from Twitter this morning...
It's gone.
Yeah, from Twitter this morning, what I understand is the end of net neutrality is going to kill the internet, destroy everything that's ever been online, probably kill people, and release waves of pestilence onto the American population.
Yeah.
Now, is any of that true?
It's not. All net neutrality is so net neutrality means that that internet providers have to provide internet speeds that are exactly the same for all websites. Now, what could happen now that net neutrality is over is that CNN could say to one of the big internet service providers, we want to pay you more so that you upload our website really quickly and upload the our competitors' websites really slowly. So people say this is unfair because it means that corporates will have control of the internet. One of their key arguments is that everything on the internet is equal and worthy. Clearly, that's not true.
Yeah.
To anyone who's been on the internet.
Yeah, because you've got our podcast and then all the others.
Yeah, like, exactly right.
Case in point.
Exactly right. So all this means is that that there's going to be more competition between internet service providers. Sometimes, you know, when innovation takes place, it's good to have a rich, exclusive market.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So this is like basically the end of net socialism.
Exactly right. As I said in an IPR review piece many years ago, this is techno-socialism.
Oof, techno-socialism.
So that's over. So we should all be... It's like the Berlin Wall coming down.
Where's David Hasselhoff?
Exactly. I don't know.
Well, you played at the end of the Berlin Wall. Cool. So we'll talk... speaking of David Hasselhoff, let's talk flamboyant performance. Milo Yiannopoulos, obviously, his tour has wrapped up this last week, but the controversy still reigns on. This is a really terrible thing about freedom of speech in Australia right now. The promoter of Milo Yiannopoulos' event is going to have to foot the bill for the police resources that were there to stop the protesters outside Milo Yiannopoulos' event.
Well, they've asked him to and he's refused.
Yeah.
$50K.
Yes, that's a lot of money. So, like, if you say something and someone else gets really amped up and starts throwing punches... It's your fault, says the Victoria Police.
It's actually bad.
It's really disgraceful.
So what's going to happen? So he said he's not going to pay.
Yeah.
And what happens next? Are they going to take him to court?
Probably. Like, if he doesn't pay and they find him, like, he eventually ends up in jail.
There you go.
Absolute hero. There are freedom of speech heroes out there. So, yeah, we'll obviously monitor that one over the summer break, but that is terrifying. The cost of freedom of speech in Victoria is $50,000.
Well, that happened to our young RPA... People having an event in Sydney, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean,
obviously
that's
not as much.
Yeah, yeah. And the university made
800 bucks.
Yeah, the university made them pay, but when Victoria Police is making you pay, it's something like, you know, something even a bit more sinister.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
Cool. So next up, let's talk the UN. One of my favorite topics.
Well, this is interesting. The UN released a report in the last few days saying that racism is on the rise in Australia.
Okay.
Which I question.
Don't question the UN, Pete.
Well,
it's going to save us. Multilateral.
Pity. How dare I, you know, question career bureaucrats and representatives of despotic regimes. But so they're saying racism on the rise and that as a result of that, Australia should tighten its 18C, reverse the burden of proof with 18C civil cases.
Yep.
The media
so
should
have
a code.
So you're not a racist?
Yeah, yeah. We should all have to prove we're not racist, James.
Every day.
What was it? The media should adopt a code of conduct, a code of good conduct.
Yeah.
So that they're not racist in the newspaper. What else? There was a few other things. Look, what I found interesting about this was, so really interesting stuff about this. You know, we always hear about how Australia's becoming more racist place, the UK is becoming more racist place, America's becoming more racist place. There was a piece in the Times this week, the UK Times, that the great mayor Matthew Less shared around the office, which talked about how even though the number of racial complaints in the UK, hate crime complaints in the UK has increased, the number of convictions has remained steady and even reduced, meaning that actually despite all these claims that racism is getting worse, it's actually not. Now, racism is a problem and we should never, you know, take it easy and we should never just, you know, dismiss it. But all these reports make the assumption that racism is getting worse, and I just find that hard to believe.
Exactly. And
I'm sure a similar thing is happening here without having any actual evidence to support that claim.
Oh, well, Pete, I don't want you to, you know, Google something.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's always a thing where it's like people start saying, oh, Australia's more racist without any evidence.
It's like,
and then it just makes everyone scared of each other. Like, it just tribalizes us. Pull your head in, UN, is what I'm going to say. Official live on the podcast.
Yeah,
cool. So that's it for the opener this week. We're now going to go to our interviews with Stuart Eaton and John Michael Howson. Before we do, obviously, Coming up to the time of the year where the IPA's Christmas appeal is starting to close up, we're starting to get towards Christmas. You can still go to our website, follow the links, and donate to the Christmas appeal. The IPA is the strongest voice for freedom and prosperity in Australia. Help us continue to be the strongest voice for freedom and prosperity in Australia in 2018. If you like the podcast, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for subscribing. We are available on iTunes, SoundCloud, and our website. Make sure you guys are subscribed. Make sure you guys are telling your friends about it. And leave us that 5-star review on iTunes just for your mates. And if you like what the IPA does around this podcast, don't forget to sign up as a member of the IPA. You can go to join.ipa.org.au or simply go to our website and follow the prompts. We've got membership packages starting as low as $22. So if you want to sign up as a member, that would be awesome. And we are coming up to Christmas. A few late, last-minute Christmas presents being wrapped. What's better than an IPA membership? What's a better present, Pete? Nothing.
Time is the best gift you can give, James.
I prefer an IPA membership. All right, cool. All right, we'll go now. Okay, we are now joined by Director of Strategic Communications and External Affairs, Stuart Eaton. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, James. Thanks, Pete. Lovely
no
to be here.
No worries, mate.
I'll see you, Adam.
I like to call Stuart Disco Stew.
Yes.
Around the office.
That's big. That's Pete's big contribution to this meeting.
Remember that song I used to go off? Anyway, don't remember.
Yeah, it was also a Simpsons character. Anyway, so Stu, obviously big year for the IPA this year. We're coming down to the Christmas appeal. It's always time to reflect on what we've been doing. So I was just thinking we could go over some of the stuff that the IPA has done this year, some of the stuff we've achieved, which has been really cool.
A time of quiet reflection, isn't it, Christmas time?
Yes. Time to be around family. I like to consider you all my family.
IPA family, yep.
Yep. Cool. So I wanted to start off with some of the fantastic work the IPA has been doing on identity politics at universities and sort of the state of Australian universities. So obviously, this week, we had the free speech on campus audit, which we talked about earlier in the show. So what have you sort of seen as like the importance of our work on universities?
Yeah, I think it's been, it's great how it's actually been able to build. It hasn't just been a one-off. So we've had the free speech on campus audit that Matthew Lesh released last week. We've also had the work from the Foundations of Western Civilization program that's looked at the free speech that's allowed in terms of what's actually being taught to university kids in terms of history classes at the moment. There's a massive focus on identity politics rather than it being about events that are actually important for people to understand. And on top of that, we've also had the identity politics side of things, which has been outside of universities, looking at things like Australia Day or the Indigenous Voice to Parliament, which has been also a big role for the IPA this year to talk about those things and talk about the potential dangers of people implementing those things.
Absolutely. And it's so important we do that because there's so little voices in Australia that argue that same sort of thing, that the fact that like there's no real push against the identity politics coming from university staff or coming from academics. It's really down to the IPA to start doing these
things. And it's also, I mean, apart from being one of the sole voices that are out there saying it, it's also one of the most consistent voices. A lot of these places that sort of spring up and they've got a particular problem with one aspect of identity politics, but then after that they're sort of happy to let those voices be pushed aside other times. And again, you know, in terms of allowing free speech and voice, obviously our year started this year very strongly with 18C. You know, it's hard to remember that back in January there was the parliamentary committee that was formed to look into the government's reforms to 18C. We had a strong representation to that committee with Simon and Chris appearing. And eventually the legislation that was put up was very much what we had suggested. Unfortunately, it didn't succeed, but it was very, very much addressed the issues we had.
Yeah, and absolutely. You can watch the video of Simon and Chris presenting to the committee on our YouTube channel.
So, Disco, we've talked about what we did this year. Mm-hmm. What's on the agenda for next year for the IPA?
Yeah, obviously, building on a lot of the things we've done. I mean, we've had some exciting innovations this year. Obviously, the podcast being one.
Innovation?
Yeah.
They've been called worse.
Well, seriously, like, how many podcasts are there?
Okay. Yeah, true.
Yeah.
But that's a really great innovation. We've also had these things we call the parliamentary research briefs that are two-page research notes we send out to all politicians about our issues or issues of the day that we think are important. So we'll certainly be building on that. But probably one of the most exciting new things we did this year was our Dignity of Work program.
I was just about to get into that.
Yeah. Which is really impressive what those guys have been able to churn out so far. Certainly, for anyone who hasn't seen Gideon Rosner's video, and apparently apparently 48,000 people have. But for anyone else who hasn't seen it...
That's a small fraction of our podcast audience.
I have no doubt. So there's a whole lot of new people I'm talking to that won't be aware of it. But, yeah, so they're really great. Gideon is a natural for the screen.
He's a real... he's very comfortable in front of the camera, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Yeah, no, I think he's walked straight off the set of Channel 9 News or something like that.
On Miami Vice, maybe.
Yeah.
Remember when we had him in for the podcast and he just started doing ad reads in the middle of the interview?
Yeah.
That was fun. Like, he's born to be a presenter.
He is, absolutely is. He's a natural. Yeah. So anyway, so building on that program will be very important for next year.
Yeah.
But obviously the overall thing for next year for us is that it's the 75th anniversary of the IPA next year. We'll have a lot of interesting events that we'll be hosting and undertaking that year, which we'll be talking to the membership about as they come together.
Very cool. Yeah, I just want to go back to the right to work thing because, again, this is something that the IPA is doing that not a lot of other people are, where obviously, like, there's so many things you can talk about with work where, you know, the economic benefits of making sure people are working, people are off welfare. But something I really think our right to work program, what Gideon's doing, which is really important, is talking about the moral case for work, like how it's, you know, you get work, like you get dignity through work, which I think is a really important point to be made.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is too. And I think it's one of those things that, you know, I know we're not a, you know, we're not a political organisation, but we start from a certain perspective on a lot of issues. And it's certainly something that throws our friends at the left because we're talking about an issue that they think is theirs in terms of people's employment rights and unemployment and what they should be able to get.
Certainly the moral case.
Yeah.
And so they have the moral.
Absolutely, they do. And so to be able to talk about that from a different perspective, I think really throws them off.
Yeah.
And to have people that are so consistent in their views, to have that well thought out case for why we think this is important, is very important to not only to our membership, but it's also important to have that consistent voice.
Yeah, exactly.
And put that argument out there. I think one of the best parts about Gideon's video in terms of the men without work is just really addressing that issue in terms of saying, did you know that, you know, 30 years ago, nine out of 10 guys of working age were actually either in a job or looking, and now it's 7 out of 10. And that's a massive drop-off, and it's a problem that I know Gideon's done a lot of research looking at what's happened in the States with that, and there's a lot of those areas that correlate with disillusioned towns that voted heavily for Trump in 2016.
Absolutely.
And there's a, you know, talking to a colleague of mine who's in Parliament, he said these are exactly the same people who are potentially going to vote One Nation. Because they feel that they're sort of being left out of the system and left out of society. And if no one's going to talk for them, they're going to get completely missed because it's certainly not the left that's talking for them. The left don't actually want them to succeed. The left just want to talk about the problems that are being caused by society.
Yeah, and it's the fault of capitalism. If you're a new listener to the show, probably about 4 or 5 months ago, I think we interviewed Nicholas Eberstadt, who was the author of the American situation, like who did a lot of research into the American situation that Stu's just talking about. So go back and listen to that. That was a really fascinating talk. But to talk about, like, taking it away from the left, which, you know, obviously we don't want to be adversarial about it. It's not like a right v left issue. People getting jobs, but it does throw people when obviously, you know, the left would see the minimum wage as the moral thing and it's just greedy capitalists who want to get rid of the minimum wage to pay their workers $2 an hour. But when you start going, like, you know, when you set a minimum wage of $15 or $16 an hour and there's certain people out there that can only really give a company about $12 of $12 an hour of work or, you know, good work. What happens to those people? Like, they just lose jobs or they get replaced by robots.
Well, they're left out of the system and it ends up being the, if it's a small business, the small business owner doing more than they want to do. I mean, they'd like to employ people. That's better for the person they employ, but it's also better for them in terms of family life and quality of life. But also looking at these people who actually just want to go and want to start. You know, why should you be penalised if someone has got 5 years' experience and you've got none? Well, your extra value that you can bring to that employer is to say, well, I'm actually happy to do it for a couple of dollars less because I want to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And
then once they have learned, they can turn around and go, I'd like to be paid a little more.
Correct. Yeah. Or, you know, now I've got this experience, I'm going to go and look for a job elsewhere. Now, that's a downside potentially if you're an employer, but at the same point in time, hopefully you've given them such a good environment they want to stay.
Exactly, exactly. So I'd also like to talk another thing that the IPA has been doing a lot of work on this year, which is Australia's red tape problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're starting on Twitter, people are starting to say just the IPA is constantly on the red tape thing with the $176 billion a year the red tape costs Australia. But it's such an important point, and it's one that I know we're going to continue to make into the new year.
Absolutely.
So what do you see as, like, you know, the problems red tape are having on Australia and what the IPA has been doing about it?
Sure. So obviously we've been running the program for a couple of years now. in terms of having a real focus on red tape. We obviously always have a pretty big focus on economic issues, but this has been something that we're seeing as a real area that a government could get into, because right now, economically, the government's not rolling in cash where they can offer out tax cuts. They're not in a position where they can start, or they shouldn't be spending on brand new programs. So we're looking for an area where they can actually make a real difference to the Australian economy that's actually not going to cost the government anything. This is a really easy win for a government who wants to actually see some solutions. You want to get out of the space in terms of telling business how to run, and you want to try and free them up to be innovative, which apparently is a very important thing, according to the federal government at the moment. So,
And agile.
And innovative, that's correct. Agile. Yeah.
Don't forget that.
No. So it's a really good opportunity for someone who can see a bit of vision in terms of where we can take things and take things at a cost, as a cost-free alternative. I think the next stages for red tape for us is we'll continue to promote our research, our findings. You mentioned the $176 billion in lost economic output by the country over each and every year due to red tape. We're also looking at things like the consequence in terms of numbers of bodies that are set up that are actually also another impetus to business, stopping business being able to succeed. So we'll continue to look at that. But we're also looking now at a more state-by-state basis as well. Next year we've got three state elections in South Australia, Tasmania and Victoria, and we'll certainly be talking to those governments and those oppositions in terms of things we think they can do to free up their economy and get their economies moving.
Yeah, I think the Victorian government stuff might be falling on deaf ears, but we'll see how we go with that.
We'll see.
Something I thought was really interesting that we were making the point of with red tape was when you look at the US, and obviously US have their own red tape issues, but it's not nearly as bad as Australia. US with red tape, it's like some of the biggest companies in the US right now didn't exist 30 years ago, like Apple and so on.
Yep.
Australia, our biggest companies were all invented in the 19, like were all formed in the 1920s, 1910s, even previous to like the 1800s.
Correct.
Australia has a real problem with getting new incumbents to come through into the market, and it's because it's so hard to get businesses off the ground. Yep. It's so hard to start employing people.
Yeah.
It's like, how much are we costing ourselves with all the red tape and with all the barriers to entry that we have?
Yeah, well, absolutely right. I mean, because that's a non-tangible in terms of putting a cost on not getting new businesses, but it's obviously in excess of the $176 billion we've already found. So it is a real significant issue. And the great thing about the US, and anyone who's been to the US, is the US is always changing, the US is always growing, there's fantastic new places to go, there's new businesses, there's new innovations that are coming out. And Australia, if you're not going to allow businesses to develop that up, we're always going to be waiting for someone else to do it. I mean, Australians are one of the highest taker-uppers of new innovations and new technology.
Yep, I'm a Bitcoin owner.
Yeah, and if...
Are you?
Yeah, I haven't mentioned it, but yeah.
I'm not on this one. Last week's, I think, got a bit of a run.
Week before that.
So if we're not going to be inventing this ourselves, we're going to be sort of customers of someone else. And surely we want to be setting the agenda as Australians rather than just being followers.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like there's something actually special in the waters of Silicon Valley that makes people entrepreneurial. It's just that's a really good place to go if you want to start a business.
Correct.
The positive thing about the US is that they're deregulating quite a bit, actually.
Yep.
And if that works, if that actually gets their economy going finally, that will start the pressure to do it here as well.
Mm. Well, you'd hope so. You'd hope like the president's tax cuts, you'd hope the federal government follows here. But at the same point in time, I noticed the president today did a stunt with the piles of red tape that exist now compared to what existed in 1960.
Yeah.
And he's got these giant piles of paper. Yeah.
Been watching our videos.
In the Oval Office. Yeah. So he's got these giant piles of paper.
Chris Begg made the exact same video 4 years ago.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
Although Chris's pile was slightly smaller than the president's, but, you know.
Got to have big piles.
Yep. So he had that there. But he was talking about how they started with a one in, two out, which is something we also have been advocating to people, which is for every new regulation that gets introduced, we think you should take two out that are insufficient. And so now they're doing one in, 22 out in the US.
22.
Wow. And that's not been just by setting the target at 22, it's just been what's happened as a result of it.
That's a very Donald Trump thing of just like, he'd probably been proposed with a one in, two out. He's just, add another two.
Yeah.
Just for the optics.
Or he's just misread it and said 22. And they've gone, all right, we can't tell him now. We've just got to go along with it.
Yeah. Well, however he came to the decision, it's a good one to make.
Yeah,
Stu, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, boys. Thanks for having me.
Actually, before we wrap up the interview, I just want to say, if you've been listening to what Stu's been saying or what we've been talking about here and you like, hot damn, I want to help the IPA out with this sort of stuff.
Hot damn.
Yeah, exactly. If you happen to be an 1860s prospector in the US, make sure you're donating to the IPA Christmas Appeal. You can go to our website and follow the links. You can help us out with that. And also, if you want to become a part of the team, make sure you sign up as a member of the IPA. Go to join.ipa.org.au. We've got membership packages starting as low as $22. And you can be, help us grow this voice for freedom and prosperity in Australia. So, Stu, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Disco.
Okay, we are now joined by John Michael Housen. John, welcome. John Michael, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Brilliant. So I want to get into this. So obviously, John Michael, you were a huge Hollywood reporter for a long time there. I think Hollywood Housen was your nickname for a while. Obviously, last few months we've been seeing a wave of sexual assault allegations coming out of Hollywood and sort of the crumbling of the Hollywood elite. Now, was this behaviour, and we have a lot of actors and people saying something we saw. Was this something that you knew was happening?
Well, I knew about some people that they were very free with their hands and whatever. But listen, that's Hollywood. This is not new. The first movie star was a woman called Florence Lawrence. And she was known as the Biograph Girl. And that was about 1910. Now, I don't know what Florence did to become the Biograph Girl, but I think the casting couch was running from that time up until, well, it's probably still running. It's just we're not told about a lot of things. But it was always part of the Hollywood deal. And not only the Hollywood deal, the deal anywhere that you want to get ahead, then you play footy with the right people. It's become the scandal du jour. So I would say, yes, there are a lot of people that are offended and upset by this, but we haven't heard about the people that said, yes, okay, you give me the part and I'll give you what you want. And I'm sure there are a lot of those around as well.
John Michael, obviously you are...
I'll just paraphrase it. I'll tell you something. Rock Hudson once said, I'll sleep with anybody as long as I get the part.
Right. So John Michael, you obviously did spend a lot of time in Hollywood and you were a known Republican. Would that be right? Did you advertise the fact that you were a card-carrying Republican whilst you were working on the Hollywood beat?
Well, not really. I mean, when my friends were all sort of that ilk, but I wasn't involved in politics or anything in Los Angeles. I mean, if we had a conversation with people, I'd make my feelings known, but it wasn't like I was... I mean, there are people that are Republicans and conservatives in Hollywood that have found their careers have hit rocky roads. I mean, just recently, Tim Allen, who had a series going, from Home Improvement.
Yeah, very popular series as well.
Very popular. And he had a new series on air, and he came out and made some pro-Trump remarks, and the series was cancelled. So one would think that if you're making a lot of money out of something, I mean, the producers, they would have said, oh, well, we don't care what he is as long as he's making money. But it's very deep. James Wood is another one who said his career has suffered because he's an outspoken Republican and he's a very fine actor. And he said work dried up for him. So it's the McCarthy list in reverse. I mean, there's just this strong element of McCarthyism in the Hollywood left, as there were many, many, many years ago with the Hollywood right. People who talk about freedom of speech and freedom of opinion, and when push comes to shove, it doesn't mean anything. I mean, Harvey Weinstein, people knew about Harvey Weinstein in the 90s. I heard about Harvey Weinstein. Now, I was down in the pecking order, I was down the bottom. But I mean, my friends and myself who worked around the business, we knew that Harvey Weinstein was a bit of a monster. But, of course, he was a huge donor to the Democratic Party. And gave millions and supported Hillary, etc. Now, when I saw Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep and others getting up and beating their breasts and saying, oh, isn't that awful, we never knew. They're lying. Everybody knew. How come these major movie stars didn't know about Harvey Weinstein if little Johnny Housen did?
Yeah, exactly.
Thought, oh, you're so ingenuous. But the reason he was protected for so long was because he was a huge donor to the Democrats.
Yeah, so something that's really become popular with like the age of Twitter and the age of Instagram and stuff is celebrities really getting on their soapbox talking about political issues. Do you think, you know, the fall of Harvey, the fall of all of these Hollywood types who used to be these, you know, moral crusaders, preening kind of types, being exposed for the monsters they are, do you reckon that's going to make really people really tune out of the celebrities getting up on their soapbox kind of culture?
Well, look, there was always a Puritan streak from the 1930s. They created a thing in Hollywood called the Hayes Office, and that was to make sure, you know, you didn't have double beds in bedroom scenes. You remember in those old movies, people always slept in single beds, etc. It was a censorship over what films could be about. So there was that moral issue. Now, of course, what it is this, I don't know where it came from. It's very nasty if women are assailed and attacked the way they have claimed to have been, and I think it's awful. You know, you're doing a job. You're not there putting yourself on the meat market, and that's something that I think is, you know, I'm glad that it's hopefully coming to an end.
So you mentioned earlier that in Hollywood there was a kind of liberal McCarthyism where people weren't of that persuasion, were sort of handed out of work. Where do you think that liberal monoculture came from?
Oh, well, you see, back in the 30s and 40s, there's always been a strong union movement in Hollywood. Fair enough. I mean, Ronald Reagan, people forget that Ronald Reagan was a union leader in Hollywood. He was head of, I think, he represented actors, whether it was the Screen Actors Guild. I think it was, actually.
Yeah, it was the Screen Actors Guild.
Yeah, he was the president of the Screen Actors Guild. There's always been a strong union movement, but Hollywood was always very patriotic in the sense that if you look at... Now, there were people of extreme leftist views in making films and that managed... And if you watch a lot of old films, you can see sort of little propaganda pieces coming in to films made in the 30s and the 40s, right? Where, particularly during the war, they managed to put little, you know, pro-communist little messages into films and even made films that were overtly pro-communist, like Mission to Moscow, you know, which was a notoriously pro-communist film made in... But it was because it was all about the Russians and they were our allies, it passed and nothing was said until years later. People looked at it and said, well, hey, wait a minute, that's just sheer propaganda. Now, I think there was always this sort of... And creative artists tend to have a small L liberal point of view. But the thing was, I think that, if you look at the old studio system, the people that ran the studios were extremely patriotic. They were mostly immigrants from other countries, and a lot of them were Jewish, but they had a great love of America, and they tried to put American values, even though they made films that were highly controversial and really well-written films, about social problems and subjects, and you look at the lineup of films of the 30s and 40s. There were films that were, you know, questioning the social situation at the time. But the general thing was people were patriotic. America was their country, and they'd stick by America. Now I know some studios gave the little white picket fence, the little white house in the garden, a sort of this is all America. They only occasionally with, say, racism, or because their films had to be shown in the Deep South, which was racist at the time. I go on like about this stuff forever because it's a big subject. But the general consensus was right across the board, we're Americans first and we're Democrats and Republicans after. In recent years, there has been this growth of... political objection to people who toe a conservative line. Where this came from, I think it's probably, you know, in the post-Reagan year, Clinton, whatever, maybe even before Reagan. But, you know, it was a soft thing. The Vietnam War certainly started a lot of it. That's where a lot of the political activism came from. But it just grew from being anti-war to anti-America, anti-free speech, anti-everything. And, of course, it has been helped by the fact that American universities have been dominated by radical left. so that, you know, you now look at what's happening on American university campuses and you wonder if this is America or Soviet Russia. I mean, it's frightening. And the same thing's happening here. But it became sort of fashionable to be leftish, radical leftish. And shows like The West Wing, you know, which was a propaganda piece for the Democratic Party written by an ardent Democrat, Aaron Sorkin, you know, fulfilled that sort of thing. That was always, I mean, you even watch detective thrillers now, and they'll have some situation that will knock conservative points of view. And they do that. They do it. It used to be sort of subtle. It's not even subtle anymore. And actors who don't fall into this line can find their careers hurt. Somebody told me once, an actor, not a movie star, but a featured actor, was having, you know, they have what they call the crafts table in studios, when you go over and get a cup of coffee and a roll or something. And when they have a break, they have a chat around the crafts table. And he said one day, I think George Bush wanted to bring in reform social security. And he said, look, I think it's a pretty good idea. The reform's needed. We're going to run out of money, et cetera. It was as simple as that. But because it was a broad George Bush policy, he was considered to be persona non grata, and he never worked on that series again.
Jeez. That's terrible. And, yeah, it just shows the sort of monoculture that exists. John Michael, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you to Stuart and John Michael Howson for those interviews. A lot of fun. So for the last time, Pete, this year, hopefully not forever, last time this year, let's go through some stories that made us laugh this week.
Let's do it.
So obviously, nanny state, huge issue around the world. Government trying to outlaw fun. It's up to the regular people to fight back. So this week at a council meeting, they're thinking about banning house parties in the suburb of Hollywood Hills in Los Angeles.
And what a place to ban house parties.
Yeah, like...
What a place.
Have they ever seen 90210?
Yeah, exactly.
So that might be Beverly Hills. Anyway.
Whatever.
The point is, it stands to the regular people to fight back against the powers of big government.
Yeah.
And so come to the front, Chad Kroeger and JT Parr.
Heroes.
Chad Kroeger Legends. Obviously being a fake name. I can't remember what his real name is. But anyway, we had it in Hey What Did I Miss. You need to see the video for the full effect. But this week's Q&A clap goes to JT Parr for making this amazing argument in defense of house parties.
If you outlaw house parties, you may keep the volume down, but an externality is that you may keep people from bonding. America needs bonding. People need to put aside their differences and find common joy. There's no more effective environment for that than a freaking rager.
Okay. Thank you.
So that was at an LA council meeting.
Yes. I hope there's an LA council version of Hansard where the phrase freaking rager will be there forever.
Immortalized.
Put it in stone.
Yeah.
So obviously, Pete and I are always jealous of people that get the Q&A clap. No one ever really applauds us for our political beliefs. So we try and game the system to make sure that we get our own Q&A clap moments. So Pete, do you have anything on the subject of house parties you want to get off your chest?
Look, I do. Few things will give you a sense of dignity and self-worth more than dominating the beer pong table all night.
Okay. Thank you.
Know. I'm a liability in the beer pong table. I was actually going to do mine in a Valley accent. So okay. Pete really didn't go with that. So.
Well, Bolt's good at accents.
All right. Well,
he's got an improvised theatre background.
I do. My Q&A clap moment is like, the McDonald's theory of international conflict is really well known, where no two countries that have ever declared war on each other had a McDonald's in both countries. So my theory is also that no two countries that have ever been at the same house party have ever declared war on each other afterwards.
Okay. Thank you.
Truth. Well said.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I should do the rest of the podcast in the Valley accent. I thought that was pretty good.
We should interview those guys.
I don't think we'll be able to find them.
That's a promise. That's a promise to you, podcast listeners. Yeah. We're going to interview them next year.
All right, Pete's on that one. Obviously, if you guys want to check out the full video, I've watched it about 17 times. Go to Hey, What Did I Miss? Now, let's talk French ambassador, Pete.
Yeah, right. Well, Spike's had a good week. Where's my...
Do you want mine? Here's the actual tweet.
The actual tweet. Okay, so this week was Pearl Harbor Day, where America commemorates the Yeah, everyone knows what it is. The French the French ambassador on that day tweeted, "In this Pearl Harbor day, we should remember that the US refused to side with France and UK to confront fascist powers in the 30s. That's from the French ambassador to the US on Pearl Harbor Day.
How do I make this really important day about me?
Well, as you can imagine, he copped a bit of flack for that.
Yeah, I'd imagine.
And look, to be honest, I mean, I found out stuff about France during the Second World War, which I didn't know prior to that, which had he not, you know, been completely rude and offensive, I wouldn't have found out.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of tweets going around at the moment, which is like, if you're from France, do you really want to start arcing up about the ability to fight back against fascism in the 30s?
Yeah.
Anyway, so yes. Questionable tweet from that guy. Yeah. Cool. So we'll also talk. So this was a really fun article. So obviously, if you are, you know, obviously we're coming up to the weekend, good time to go on dates. Some of you might be intersectional feminists or about to go on a date with an intersectional feminist.
You should always, this shouldn't be afraid of people that challenge your ideas, you know?
No.
And that creates a bit of frisson, I find, in a romantic setting.
Well, I think the author, the author of this article, Lara, with 10 things every intersectional feminist should ask on a first date, is quite afraid of what other people think if they differ from her.
Yeah.
So, obviously, she's 10 things every intersectional feminist should ask on a first date. She's just got 10 questions, why they should be asked, and why anything other than outright agreement with you should be treated as sinful. So, Pete, I'm just going to ask you a few of these questions. I just want to get your thoughts on...
I just want to be friends, mate. No. Like, I know we've got a good relationship. But...
Yeah.
Well, let's anyway, sorry. Anyway. So, for the podcast. Yeah,
pretend that we're on a date.
Yeah.
Adam, the waiter.
I'm here.
Putting down some whites.
Yeah. You go with Adam, not
kidding. Pete, what are your thoughts on gender and sexual orientation?
Yeah.
Apparently quite important to this
date. I'm pro both.
Okay, good. Because gender binary is a tiny box and I wish it didn't exist, says the article, but it does. I wouldn't want to be with anyone who is queerphobic. So I don't think you are queerphobic, so we'll move on.
Boom.
How do you work to dismantle sexism and misogyny in your life?
Just not bad to people. I don't do it.
I need more.
I'm not sexist. What is it again? Sexist and misogyny.
Sexism and misogyny. How do you work to dismantle it?
I abstain from those.
I don't know if that's enough. I think that's evidence of your, what Lara would describe as toxic masculinity coming
through.
Yeah. I think you need to be outright active.
Once again, I've been called worse. I've been called worse than toxic.
Toxic masculinity.
How many more of these are there, James?
Oh, there's 10. Because, like,
I'm a pretty easy date. You
know? No, Pete. Get us a couple of drinks, mate. Pete, Lara Witt says I need to ask all 10 of these questions in this hellscape of a date that this would be.
Yeah. Yep.
Imagine this absolute grilling.
Oh, I've got to go and wash my cat's hair.
Yeah. Do you think capitalism is exploitative?
No.
Really?
No.
Well, I think this date's got to end. You got to question 7, but this date's got to end.
Yeah.
Sorry, man.
So is that one of them?
Yeah. What's, do you think capitalism is exploitative? Anti-capitalism, especially in the US, is imperative if you have an understanding of our systemic racism, the prison industrial complex, the 13th Amendment, and exploitation. Apparently, all of that has something to do with capitalism.
So
capitalism, for one, teaches us that we're only valuable if we produce capital. Don't know if you knew that. That means if you aren't contributing to the system with your labor, your life means almost nothing. I think this, that's a fundamental misunderstanding.
This is why feminism misses a lot. Yeah. It's because it's really socialist.
Exactly, yeah.
If it was more freedom-based, it would have a lot more mainstream support.
Yeah, Pete.
Not, I don't want to get all deep about this. It is the first day, you know. Yeah. You kept it light.
Anyway, so Pete, I'm afraid you probably wouldn't pass a date with an intersectional feminist, but I don't know. I think you could bounce back.
I don't know, mate.
Other fish.
Be pretty persuasive. So what's the next one?
Oh, dear. Cool, so... this is really cool research from the University of Duh. University of Duh?
Okay.
Might also know it as its former name, the University of you think? Heavy Mark, sorry, Pete.
I thought it was a real university.
No, it's definitely not. So there's a report out, it's actually from the University of Sydney, saying that pizza and beer ads lead to poor student diets. Well, it's not even a duh. It's just like, I don't think it's the ads, mate. It's just students tend
you're
to like
pizza.
You're
going to have a hard time getting people off that.
Yeah.
I think that you should smash heaps of beers and pizza when you're a student because, you know, you'll still look great. It's only when you get older
you can take it.
I was a fat uni student. I did not look great. So
a bit sad. Yeah,
so, well, you know, truth's out there. I've lost it now, I think. This article, so they're saying heavy marketing of pizza and alcohol on university campuses is contributing to poor diets and unhealthy lifestyle in students.
Yeah.
Again, I don't think it's the ads. I think it is a bunch of students that go... there's actually no one that can stop me eating a pizza and having a beer right now.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
that once you know that, that's hard to come back from.
And even if it was the ads, who cares?
Yeah, exactly. I think you should be able to advertise whatever you want.
Thanks for that, University of Sydney.
University of Duh, I think it was. Oh. Cool. So that is it for this week and therefore this year. Thank you guys so much for listening. It has been a really cool year. Like, obviously, we started this podcast on a Women of Prayer back in February, you want to say?
March.
March, okay. our podcast historian, Pete, over here. So, yeah, thanks so much for listening. It was a bit of a gamble on the IPA spot, I think. You know, pretty untested waters. There's not a lot of political podcasts in Australia, certainly not ones that are just of its own back podcast. You know, it's always like a radio show's podcast version. We didn't really know what we were getting into, but obviously you guys have really started to appreciate. Sorry,
right.
I'm so sick. I'm not a hero, but I am really sick right now.
Yeah.
But I'm still doing a podcast.
He's literally sick.
Yeah.
I physically vomit. He didn't vomit, but he's got like...
anyway, I think we're disrupting the flow here, but anyway. no, you guys have been really cool. We've had more subscribers than we thought. We've had a bunch of 5-star reviews, people getting in touch to say how much they really enjoy the podcast.
Lots of positive feedback, which we thank you all for.
Yeah, we're like, I think we are now the biggest sole political podcast, like not tied to a radio show in Australia. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, routinely beating Bill Maher, Rachel Maddow in the iTunes charts in Australia. So that's awesome.
Suck on that, Bill Maher.
It's led to some really cool interviews. Obviously, we've had David Lionhelm through here, James Patterson, Sam Destiari, although we probably shouldn't mention that one anymore. Nicholas Zabistart, Mary Kissel, Pete and I have been on New York radio show, and personal goal for me, I interviewed an NBA star,
yeah, exactly,
and championship winner, Andrew Bogut. That was crazy.
We've got so many big plans for interviews next year as
we
well.
We do indeed.
Trump.
Yep. Pete always says we should interview Trump. We should interview Trump, but it's just, man's pretty busy.
Do you want he's the kind of bloke that might just go.
You know what?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Cancel my 4 o'clock.
With the French ambassador.
Yeah.
Cool. So, yeah, thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you guys so much for subscribing. That's it. We're available on iTunes, SoundCloud, and our website. Make sure you guys are subscribed on whatever platform you want. Make sure you're telling your friends. Sorry, Pete.
One thing. When are we back?
We are back, I don't know, first week back?
Yeah.
You know, a bit of summer holiday recap.
So, it's January.
Yeah. We'll be back January. Obviously, the podcast will just show up in your feed. We can't do next week because we are out of here. No, I'm going to be interstate. So, yeah, we'll have the show back for you guys. So, make sure, yeah, so as I said, make sure you subscribe, make sure you download it, make sure you're leaving those 5-star reviews. If you like what the IPA does, obviously, we've been talking a lot this week, episode about what the IPA has done this year and what we're going to be thinking of next year. If you want to become part of the IPA, make sure you go to join.ipa.org.au. We've got membership packages starting as low as $22, and there's just a few days left to donate to the IPA's Christmas appeal. So make sure you go to our website, follow the prompts, and help the IPA out for 2018. Thank you guys so much.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like mumps at the night. Oh, but probably truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.